Murdoch University presents Enlightened Conversations, produced by Pixel Sift. Welcome to Enlightened Conversations. It's a new limited podcast series from Murdoch University. My name is Gianni DiGiovanni. I'm the executive producer of Pixel Sift, and I'll be your guide through the discussion today. This is episode 5. Psychologist and author Steve Pinker argued in his 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, that we're currently living in the most peaceful era of the human species. Yet, the history of humanity is marked by war and violent action, and some of those wars were waged for a religious belief. So does religion motivate violence, or do political, economic, and social conditions have a greater role to play? My guests are Mark Jennings, lecturer in religious studies, sociology, and religion, and Robert Miles, lecturer in New Testament and religion. Mark, prominent and outspoken atheist Richard Dawkins has said that only religious faith is strong enough to a force to motivate such utter madness in otherwise sane and decent people. How would you respond to that?
I think when I hear that kind of rhetoric, and it is rhetoric, I think what is obscured by a statement like that is the nature of what we might call non-religious violence. So in his book, The Myth of Religious Violence, William Kavanagh explores this whole dualism between religion and secular violence. And on the one hand, religious violence is always irrational, excessive, and requires the secular violence, which is rational and measured, to come in and control it. Hence, we can bomb Syria with impunity, as President Obama repeatedly has done, because our violence, that is secular Western violence, is required to mitigate or contain this irrational violence that is essentially religious. And yes, it elides all of the politics, the ethno-nationalism that goes into that. And I mean, Kavanagh's also very interested in defining religion itself, which is always another thing that's kind of skated over, which is notoriously slippery concept, religion. I've never read anything by Dawkins in particular that gives me the impression he understands religion at all, to be perfectly honest. But that kind of rhetoric does sell his books.
Robert?
Mm. I think I agree with most of that. And I would want to add, in terms of defining religion, we should also start to think about how we conceptualize violence. So we tend to conceptualize or think about violence and religious violence as visible, individualized forms of violence that we can quite clearly point to, but we tend to shy away from what we might call objective violence or systemic violence. So those forms of violence that are often invisible but are actually inherent to the everyday functioning of life as we know it.
Can you give us an example of what you'd mean by that?
So the way in which institutions may structurally disadvantage certain groups of people, for example. And also I think if we expand our definition of violence to maybe include things like symbolic forms of violence, so the way in which language or imagery can be violent. And in this sense, you know, religion has its part to play. I think that the central motif of Christianity is a crucifix, is an instrument of violent
torture.
Of torture.
And execution.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think adding to what Mark said and responding to that quote from Dawkins. I find Dawkins' approach to be quite simplistic. I think that the truth of this quite thorny issue of religion and violence is far more complex than he would let on.
Where do you think, I guess, is the next logical place to take it then? If we haven't even properly defined what religion or ideology or belief really is, how would you sort of classify it and then its interaction with violence?
Well, I think you're like, that question is exactly right, that before we even get into discussing this issue, we have to first have done what we've done, which is to go back and break down some of our definitions and presuppositions and so on. And at that point, we realize, okay, well, this is, you know, a thorny issue, complex issue. In terms of proceeding, what I would then generally do would be to come up with a working definition of religion. So let's say religion is what people generally refer to as being religious. But that in itself is riddled with problems because, as Mark has already alluded to, the idea that religion exists as something outside of or separate to culture is a very modern Western liberal idea. And I think where I would take the discussion now would be more along the lines of trying to see the ways in which religion is there in whatever discussion, or to talk about religion in this broader sense of religion being there in terms of both as propensity for good, for evil, motivating good behaviors, evil behaviors, and so on, and assess them at that level.
Yes, and I agree with all of that. And I think the pronouncements of the so-called new atheists, people like Dawkins and Sam Harris and the late, great Chris Hitchens, they make a straw man out of religious belief. In the way that I talked about when we started, violence is not limited to religion. And I think the frightening thing about blaming all violence on religion is that it conceals the nature of other problematic forms of violence. Mm. But yeah, defining religion, this is something I do in my class. Well, I don't do. I throw open to my students in my classes, and it turns out it's both really easy and really hard. So one of the prominent religious scholars in the United States, Jonathan Smith, has defined religion in 50 ways. You can define religion in 50 ways. So it's actually really easy to define religion, but to come up with one that everybody agrees with, it turns out to be really hard. Do you include something like Taoist Buddhism, which doesn't have a kind of a personal god in the same way that
charismatic figure?
Yes, it does have at its foundation, at its beginnings, perhaps a charismatic figure, but it doesn't have a personal god in the same way that Christianity does. So it turns out that really, when we say religion, we actually have in mind something along the lines of Protestant Christianity, that. Is because that particular faith has been so important in colonizing most of the Anglophone world, particularly, and has been significant in becoming the kind of the dominant ideology or underlying the dominant ideology in a lot of the world.
Do you think, I guess, the difficulty in actually categorizing religion and actually starting this conversation is part of what causes conflicts between people?
It definitely is not divorced from conflict. So if we go back to the example of some of those new atheists, they themselves are coming from exactly this. Even if they're not ardent believers in Protestant Christianity, they're still products of a culture that came up with this definition of religion that looks at the world and kind of looks to other parts of the world and sees religions in the same way that they see religion in the Anglophone world, as Mark pointed out. Some of those new atheists were supporters of the war on terror, because they were motivated by, whether explicitly or implicitly, because they were motivated by arguments that suggested, okay, well, if religion is the cause of violence or most violence in the world, if we get rid of religion, we'll get rid of violence. So they saw.
So you still think that's fundamentally coming from a religious perspective, even though they are an atheist? Is that sort of the point of view you're saying, that like their formational thoughts are actually from a certain perspective?
Well, their whole understanding of what is religious itself comes from Christianity's entanglement with the Western world and through modernity and the Enlightenment, where religion was conceptualized in this nice, neat little package kind of way of referring to the beliefs of a predominantly Christian worldview and so on. But that clear-cut distinction, it just doesn't exist in through most of history, through most parts of the world. People aren't can't so easily talk about their religious ideas and beliefs in a way that's separate from other political, economic, or social and cultural ideas. I can give an example of this from my area of focus, which is early Christianity, within the Roman world, where the Caesars, for example, were proclaimed as gods and sons of God. And so Caesar Augustus as the son of God. But why were they proclaimed using this language? Well, it was the idea that the gods were actively involved in upholding political power and institutions on earth. So when, for example, the early Christians started proclaiming someone like Jesus as son of God, someone who had actually been crucified by the Roman Empire to begin with, they were making not only religious claims but profoundly political ones as well. And if we, zoom back to our age and we look at these texts, we tend to think of those proclamations that Jesus was son of God or whatever as religious proclamations. But to anybody in the first century in the Roman world, they would hear them equally as religious as they would political. So that shows a limitation of our understanding and our worldview where we are today in the modern West, where we have this clear-cut distinction between a so-called secular world and so-called religious world.
Do you think that bears thinking about when we are talking about modern day conflicts as well, and the way that we might see religiously or even ideologically motivated violence in in that sort of context, and we should be thinking about it not from our Western, maybe Judeo-Christian sort of perspective, but think maybe there are other cultures out there who have different perspectives on what they think of religion as being?
I think that, for example, the noble idea to want to impose a model of secular society globally around the world is not always going to work, because it may, to an extent, work within the West because that whole notion emerged within this context of the West. So it's not necessarily going to work without resistance, without conflict, or without creating conflicts or tensions in other parts of the world.
We are who we are. So, I mean, we sit here today in an academic institution, product of the Enlightenment. I can't transpose myself into the medieval worldview, as obsessed as I am with medieval literature and writing. As my mentor, Alex Jensen, used to say to me, you can never really understand medieval thought, but you kind of get used to it if you read it. Same with other cultures. I'm Western born, and to say, look, I can transpose myself and understand culture in the same way as my colleague here, Vijay Mishra, understands Hinduism. So we've talked about Hinduism. He's a practicing Hindu among many other things, and he thinks he doesn't separate doctrine and life the way that is kind of de jure in Christian theology. So I've asked him sort of doctrinal questions, and he's saying, well, this is so much a part of culture that I can't really answer the question the way that you've framed it. So that's not really an answer, and it's not not very hopeful, I suppose. But the idea is that you can't be other than you are. I think you have to be aware that there are these major differences between this kind of Western liberal secularized. I mean, we're sitting here in Australia. We could think about American exceptionalism, for example, where America remains a very pious country, as well as being a very modern one. So Europe, Australia, definitely, we're highly secular, but American secularism is a kind of a rare beast, all on its own. We can't be other than what we are, but we can acknowledge, as we've, I think, tried to do today, that there are different ways of understanding this this whole thing, religion, or not understanding it.
I just want to read you another quote. We've got Karen Armstrong, who's a British author and commentator. She's of Irish Catholic descent and was a former Roman Catholic nun. She's written a number of books on comparative religion. She said, all the world's great religious traditions share as one of their most essential tenets the imperative of treating others as one would wish to be treated oneself. We have seen examples, of course, especially in the Christian faith, you know, through many examples. We can think of the Crusades into Jerusalem during, I think, the 12th century, which was done to nominally capture that land back for the Christian faith to hold onto it against apostates and other people out there. How does it become skewed? Does that sort of system, which treat others unto how you would like to be treated, become an us versus them sort of situation?
I think, first of all, I'd want to just dissect Karen Armstrong's idea there, because I think that she engages in actually quite a common essentializing of religion, this idea that true religion, or at the core of religion, is some principle that's ultimately good and peaceful, and, you know, it's about promoting harmony and peace and charity and so on. And so, conversely, violent religions or violent acts done in the name of religion are distortions of the true nature, the true essential identity of that religion. And I would take issue with that. I would say that religions, religious ideas, religious movements have the propensity both for extreme good and extreme evil, and I would want to analyze and discuss both side by side. I don't know if Mark wants to.
Yes, I agree with that. I think Armstrong's views on religion need to be problematized, because, and I've seen this with her before, she actually takes quite an individual and internal view of religion. Religion's what goes on in here. Sorry, listeners, I'm pointing to my chest for some reason, but it goes on inside my soul. It goes on inside my mind, perhaps. This is a very modern idea of religion, the idea that there's some kind of inner self that's the real sort of ground of religious faith. So I think her ideas about what a religion essentially is, as Robert's pointed out, is very idealized. And I think religion, when I started by saying we need to talk about the distinction between secular and religious violence, I'm certainly not giving religion a pass. I think there is a lot of whatever we end up defining religion as, I think there is a lot of violence that can be laid at the feet of people of faith and religion itself. So, yeah, I agree with that as well. The Crusades, I mean, this is the hoary old chestnut that's always brought up, isn't it? I mean, look, the interaction between Islam from its beginnings in the 7th century, moving up into Byzantium and then across North Africa into the Iberian Peninsula, ultimately stopped by the so-called saviours of Europe, the Franks. There is all sorts of myths of origin going on in that story. The beginning of Europe, which, if you think about that story, really exists as the other to Islam. That's what Europe is.
Could we touch on as well, I guess, ideology that is not
as we would understand it, to be religiously motivated. We've seen a rise of a number of far-right ideologies online, which have prompted violence sort of popping up in small little cells. Would you kind of equate them into the way that sort of religion may have developed in small cultural groups as sort of a tribal sort of function, in the way we would understand how, you know, groups of Jews suffering from persecution might have banded together and their laws sort of became their religious beliefs to kind of keep their social groups together? Or is that a simplification?
A little bit. That's okay. I mean, I think the example works because so many of these right-wing groups, from what I understand of them, do arise in response to particular threats that, if you ask members of these groups, would perhaps say are religious. So a lot of right-wing ideology is Islamophobic, for example, today. So in our own Australian politics, we have the politics of fear, as personified by One Nation and Pauline Hanson, which is focused recently in its most recent manifestation about concerned with Islam. So yes, I see how the example works in that way, in terms of whether that kind of nationalism can be seen in itself as religious. I know a lot of theologians want to define religion and faith in contradistinction to that specifically. So Paul Tillich, for example, is a theologian writing around about the time of the Third Reich, a German who wrote a lot in English, and he wants to call ultimate concern the fundamental thing about faith. And ultimate means transcending life. So, and he does that deliberately because he wants to define faith as different from nationalism, from the nationalism that he so hated, so worked against in the Third Reich. So I see the example, but I think a lot of people of faith themselves would say, well, that's not really religion. But, I mean, that's what we've been playing with this whole discussion, isn't it?
Robert, what do you think about, I guess, the persecution of early Christians from that period of time, and, you know, their societal organization as a function, and then contrasting that with other ideologies that may have be more prevalent online?
So, this is a really fascinating and interesting aspect, I think, because many scholars now would see the almost indulgence in this myth of persecution of the early Christians as something that was intentionally grasped upon and overstated in a way to bolster their own religious identity. But the reason for doing that was because one of the primary drivers for doing that was because it allowed these groups of early Christians to identify with Christ, who was one who himself was a supposed righteous martyr, who had been put to death unjustly on the cross. And so these early Christian groups they might not have been deliberately targeted by the Romans. They might have simply been being prosecuted for causing disturbances or whatever, but they understood it as persecution. And not only that, but that it justified their very existence and their beliefs in what they were doing and everything else. That myth of religious persecution, to a certain extent, has become culturally imprinted on the Western world, and perhaps on the Western secular world. And this is where I'd be willing to go, and I realize that this wouldn't be the most, you might be able to pull this analogy and so on apart, but thinking of the formation of alt-right groups and so on, and the fact that they, and not only alt-right, but also the alt-light, that they would very vocally claim that they're responding to being persecuted, to being shut out of society and so on. It seems like it's often tapping in implicitly to this martyr complex, this idea that we value those who are being unjustly persecuted for sincere beliefs, for holding sincere beliefs. So at least at the rhetorical level, that seems to be how they're trying to galvanize, you know, their cause and show the righteousness of their cause.
And I guess just finally, when we're talking about this, to bring it back to the beginning topic, we're talking about the interaction between religion and belief and violence. How would you sort of suggest to people to think about it if they want to think more about this topic and they want to explore it in a different way? Where would you sort of send people to? Or even where would you get them to start thinking?
Well, forgive the shameless plug, listeners, but my colleague here, Robert Miles, is running a unit called Religion and Popular Culture in second semester. So that would be an excellent place to start. I think what we encourage people to be is critical thinkers, to read the news, to understand the news, and to have this kind of critical eye, this suspicious eye even, every time we read stories. Mm-hmm. And to think a little bit more broadly even than we've discussed here. I mean, Robert actually mentioned some of this about violence and structural violence. So we need to think also about the ways that, and this relates to Robert's last point, the ways that communities of faith continue to assert their right to discriminate. Assert their right, some forms of Christianity and other forms of faith assert their right to marginalize and silence women, to persecute people, LGBTIQ people, while at the same time claiming themselves to be persecuted. And, you know, let's name the elephant in the room. I'm talking about that rugby guy, Israel Folau. And it, what makes his story so particularly fascinating in terms of Christian faith, of course, is that he is he doesn't actually hold to the Orthodox Christian faith at all. He's actually said publicly that he doesn't believe in the Trinity, which is an obscure kind of idea today, perhaps, but it's a very important idea of being a Christian. So, I mean, Israel Folau probably would have been burned 500 or so years ago for his denial of the Trinity. Yet he's kind of lionized as an example of religious persecution. For holding this whole other area of discrimination that he claims to have the mandate to continue to proclaim.
Right.
I think just to reaffirm what Mark said, that we need to, when we're reading about, particularly in the media, reports on so-called religion, so-called the interaction of religion and violence, I would be suspicious of any cavalier definitions of religion, of violence. If violence is described as being religiously motivated, then I think it's important to ask in what ways are we constructing religion? In what ways are we constructing violence here? And I think also, as Mark said, to try and pay attention to those invisible forms of violence that often go under the radar because we're so used to them in our engagement with everyday life that we're not attuned to them. We're not attuned to seeing them. So, but in terms of what to read, we'll read everything. Just go and read, everything. Go and study.
That was episode 5, the final episode of Enlightened Conversations, a limited podcast series by Murdoch University and produced by Pixel Sift. My name is Gianni DiGiovanni. Thank you so much for joining me. Pixel Sift is Gianni DiGiovanni, Scott Quigg, Mitch Lowe, Fiona Bartholomeus, and Sarah Ireland. Our theme music is The Other Side by Nihilor. For more information about Murdoch University, you can head to murdoch.edu.au, where you can expand your mind and have these broad conversations about the future of the world and where we sit in it. If you enjoyed that conversation, tell a friend. This is the final episode for this limited series. Thank you for joining me as we explored some big topics and had some fascinating discussions. I learned a lot from our guests, and I hope you did too. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Enlightened Conversations.